we realized, because of the nature of our product, incredibly boring product, we knew we needed to do something to stand out. And so somehow, miraculously, we convinced Simon to sit on a toilet on a live stream until we raised our first $50,000, which was a lot of money in crowdfunding terms back then.
Yeah.
And so he sat on a live stream on the toilet for about 50 hours with the world watching. So we had, you know, thousands of people tuning in from Brazil and Greece and Australia and the United States. And we did reach our goal. And several months later, we delivered our first product. And it's been a wild ride since then.
Tap into the minds of change makers creating real impact on people and our planet. It's time to live your purpose. I'm your host, Dale Wilkinson, and this is Good Makers. What is up? Thank you for tuning in to episode 27. I'm so glad you decided to drop by because this episode is such a good one. But first, if you're a new listener, I'd love for you to become a regular. So hit subscribe to get notified when we release a new episode, which is every single week. I have the pleasure to interview social entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and good humans doing work that matters so you can learn how they do it and create a career and life of purpose for yourself. This episode, I got the chance to speak with Danny Alexander, co-founder of toilet paper brand Who Gives a Crap. Not only is the toilet paper good for the environment, being made out of 100% recyclable paper and sustainable bamboo, but they also donate 50% of their profits to build toilets to help 2 billion people get access to proper sanitation. Danny talks us through their thought process behind building such a bold and humorous brand and what they did in the early days to stand out when they didn't have a marketing budget. He also shares what they're looking for in candidates when they're hiring new team members and how they're able to keep the whole team aligned with their ambitious mission that they've set for the next 30 years. This episode is full of helpful takeaways. So let's jump into my chat with a guy who really does give a crap, Danny Alexander. Danny, how you doing, sir? Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So 2020 has been a wild year for all of us, but you've been in a unique position being a co-founder of a toilet paper brand. Can you tell us, can you walk us through what those early days of the pandemic looked like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's we were a remote first toilet paper, direct to consumer toilet paper brand. So if ever there was a year for us to step up, I think this was our opportunity. So, you know, it's worth acknowledging in the beginning of 2020, or at least in the beginning of the pandemic, we were experiencing the same things everyone else in the world was, right? We were unsure about our own health and our family's health and if we could leave the house and what was happening. And so on a personal level, I think we were all confronting the same challenges everyone else was.
Yeah.
On a professional level, things were relatively normal until about mid-March. And when things started to escalate in terms of the pandemic, we started to see some pretty extreme shopping behavior. So from one day to the next, we saw sales grow, you know, several 100%. And then the next day we saw it go up by about 1,100%.
Wow.
And so we were selling about as much toilet paper in a single day as we usually sell in a month, which is pretty crazy. We, at one point, I think we were selling like 28 rolls of toilet paper a second. So it was just flying off our virtual shelves. So, you know, really exciting, of course. Great to see the business doing well, even though we were, you know, struggling on the personal side. But yeah, it did present a number of challenges for us. We've, you know, as a toilet paper brand, we've spent the whole history of our business trying to never run out of toilet paper. And all of a sudden, we were confronting this challenge that we'd actually never even built a sold out feature into our website. We actually didn't know how to mark the website as sold out and stop selling toilet paper. And so in that day that we were seeing the highest levels of sales, we had to make the hard decision to basically drop everything, have a team basically focus entirely on figuring out how do we mark as sold out and not oversell our stock. We really wanted to make sure we weren't disappointing people when we, you know, when they paid for something and didn't get it. And so we made that hard decision to sell out. We reserved enough inventory to be able to fulfill all of our subscribers' orders so we could continue shipping to them. But we put up a pop-up on our website that said, sign up for, enter your email and sign up for an update on when we have more inventory. Within a couple of weeks, we had over 500,000 people sign up for our email list just from that pop-up. And so it was a pretty crazy time. And, you know, the process of going back in stock and figuring out how to distribute products to the people who need it most was a big challenge, but one that our team really stepped up to do.
Wow. So that was 500,000 new signups.
Correct.
So a lot of them hadn't maybe have heard of Who Gives a Crap. They were just like looking for toilet paper wherever they could find it.
Yeah. I mean, we had a number of people of our existing customers sign up as well. But yeah, I think we had about 500,000, if not a little bit more, new customers.
That's incredible. And then, so you were already remote first as a workplace. So there wasn't too much challenge kind of dealing with that when obviously there was this increase of need for your product.
Yeah, well, we founded the business fully remotely. I was, as you can tell from my accent, I'm American, but my co-founders are both Australian, and the first 25 or 30 employees we hired fully remotely. We shifted it in the past couple of years, and we've actually built out hubs in Los Angeles and in Melbourne and Manila and distributed team in China. But we've always had a really strong remote part of our work. And so all of our meetings happen on Zoom, you know, pretty much all of our conversations happen on Slack. And so we had the sort of tools and capabilities to be able to go fully remote really easily. So pretty quick shifts that worked well for us.
Gotcha. Can you take us back to the beginning of Who Gives a Crap? How did it originate? Where did the idea come from? Was it the issue first, then the product, or were you in the toilet paper business beforehand? How did it come about?
No, I actually don't think even at 100 employees, I don't think we have a single one that's ever worked in the toilet paper industry before. classic challenger brand, right? I think the like all great ideas, it started in the bathroom. My co-founder had the original idea. Ultimately, he was running a number of other businesses at the time. He had started a nonprofit search engine and a nonprofit bar. And he was basically trying to find a way of using business to drive massive social impact. And what he realized is that in order to do that, he needed to find a product or a service or something that could scale really big. And so he was on the lookout, actively looking for products or services that might be able to scale. And he had this epiphany when he walked into a bathroom, saw a few rolls of toilet paper and said, "That's it. We'll sell toilet paper. We'll call it Who Gives a Crap, and we'll donate half of our profits to help build toilets." And so that was the epiphany moment. And, you know, from the beginning, we've essentially tried to solve two major problems. One is environmental and the other is societal. On the environmental front, we make all of our toilet paper and other products out of more environmentally friendly materials like recycled paper or bamboo. And then on the societal front, like I said earlier, we donate half of our profits to help build toilets around the world.
Yeah.
There are currently about 2 billion people in the world who don't have access to even the most basic form of sanitation. So we're essentially trying to drive the success of our business. We're hoping to connect the success of our business to positive societal change like that.
So it was the kind of the product, the idea of the toilet paper first, and then researching this fact that there's 2 billion people that don't have access to a proper toilet.
Well, it was founded in an understanding of the fact that sanitation was one of the most of all of the goals that we've set as a sort of global community, the sustainable development goals. Sanitation is the one that's often the one left behind. And so my co-founder had done plenty of work. Simon, our CEO, had done plenty of work traveling throughout Africa and Southeast Asia and had seen the impact of this firsthand. In the early days of Who Gives a Crap, I also had a background in sanitation from a design and innovation perspective. So it wasn't an issue we didn't know anything about, but we were really looking for the business model first, and then the product sort of magically fit.
Gotcha. And then how did you and Simon meet? And then did he was already kind of in development of the idea, and he kind of pitched that to you? How did that happen?
Yeah, great question. He and Jehan, our third co-founder, had been, I believe they went to university together and had started one of the social enterprises together before. And so they jumped in and decided to do it together. And they pitched it to a business plan competition here in the States. Essentially, it's sort of an incubator program. And I was there at this program as a mentor, teaching design thinking and how to bring a product or a product idea to life. And they were there, and I met them and was totally captivated by their vision and just thought, you know, what's the worst that could happen? At least I'll have a heck of a lot of fun in the next few years.
Right.
Even if the business doesn't work. And so, and it's been true. I've had, you know, the best eight or 10 years of my life doing this. So it's been a pretty marvelous journey.
Was that the first time working with Australians? Any major differences that you found?
actually a lot of major differences. We do have, you know, a substantial team in Australia. That's where we started the business really, and where probably our strongest brand presence is. There are plenty of differences, of course, in how we use language and things like that. Also just sort of expectations around how to balance work and life are different. And but overall, I think we're always amazed by how much we have in common across our teams rather than how much we differ.
At the early days of building Who Gives a Crap, it launched in Australia first.
Yeah, we did. Actually, I should tell you the sort of origin story of how we got off the ground. It was a heck of a ride. I met Jehan and Simon when they had just an idea and a business plan, and we worked together to design the product and find the manufacturer and figure out how to actually bring this product to life. And ultimately, we realized that, you know, one, we wanted to self-fund this, and that we knew we would have a hard time pitching both a toilet paper brand name, Who Gives a Crap, but also a company that donates half of its profits to charity. We knew we'd have a hard time finding venture capitalists to back us.
Right.
So we decided to bootstrap it, and we launched a crowdfunding campaign. In the early days of crowdfunding, we realized, because of the nature of our product, incredibly boring product, we knew we needed to do something to stand out. And so somehow, miraculously, we convinced Simon to sit on a toilet on a live stream until we raised our first $50,000, which was a lot of money in crowdfunding terms back then.
Yeah.
So he sat on a live stream on the toilet for about 50 hours with the world watching. And so we had thousands of people tuning in from Brazil and Greece and Australia and the United States. And we did reach our goal. And several months later, we delivered our first product. And it's been a wild ride since then.
That is hilarious. The whole brand of Who Gives a Crap, from the name of the product and your copy, your marketing, everything you're doing is so clever, so funny, really cheeky. Why did you go for that direction?
Yeah. You know, Simon had the brand name idea. And to be honest, when I first heard about the brand name, I actually thought it was a little too provocative. You know, I think in the early days when we did end up launching in the States a few years ago, we tested different brand names because we weren't sure if the American market was ready for such a bold, provocative name. Turns out enough people were ready for it that we thought it was a good idea. But yeah, from the beginning, we realized that in order to stand out, we didn't have the money to invest a lot in marketing, nor did we think that was the best use of our money in the early days. We wanted to really focus on building the best product quality we could and the best experience we could and donating as much as possible. And so in the early days, the first several years of the business, we relied only on word of mouth to grow the business. And as part of that, we knew that we needed to do whatever we could to make it something worth talking about. So hence the ridiculous brand name, hence the funny copy on the packages and the, you know, the individually wrapped paper wrapped rolls with the beautiful packaging. And really all of that was intended to help us drive word of mouth marketing.
A lot of these companies in the social impact space are trying to get into the space, and they have this model of 5-10% of their profits go to a charity. You have a whopping number of 50% of your profit goes to charities. What was that thought process?
Yeah, I think part of it was a recognition that we needed to do to be bold in everything we did,
right,
including the brand name and the packaging to stand out. I think the other part of it was a recognition that business is the greatest engine of growth we've ever seen as humans. It has driven more wealth creation than anything else in the world. What it's done a poor job of historically is wealth redistribution. And so we realized that if we could make a bold thing like this work, that we could theoretically inspire a big shift in how we think about business and the role of business in solving problems. And so we, you know, in the early days, I remember having conversations with Simon and saying, you know, what if we just shifted this to 25% and invested more in marketing? Or, you know, what if we cut it to 10%? And, you know, in the early days we were donating, our first donation was $2,500. It wouldn't have made a massive difference if we had switched it in those early days. But to Simon's credit, he really kept his eye on the prize and basically said, we need to be bold and we need to do this differently and we need to prove it can work. And so we've stuck to our guns, and now it's too late to change it now. So we're running with it.
That's awesome. And how much to date have you been able to donate?
Yeah, we've donated a little over $5 million, about $5.7 million to charity since we founded the business. So I'm incredibly proud of that. I still
That's
remember
awesome.
When we donated our first check of $2,500. I was proud of it then, and I'm proud of it now. But ultimately, our eye is on the bigger prize. And so we're looking forward. And essentially, our big, hairy, audacious goal as a business is to make sure everyone on earth has access to a toilet.
Going back to what you were talking about when you were first starting the brand and you didn't have a marketing budget and you wanted to stand out, be bold. Do you have any marketing lessons for other founders that could be at that stage, early stage, they working on a mission-driven business and they don't have a marketing budget?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we were pretty diehard adherents of the lean startup methodology in the early days of the business. And we still refer to it a lot. And I think one of the most important lessons from that book is to focus all of your early efforts on identifying what your value hypothesis is. And by value hypothesis, it's really what's the value you're offering to someone that's going to make them want to talk to buy your product. And I think so much effort is being spent on marketing and scaling through marketing in the early days that people forget about making the product so good that it should sell itself. And so the reason we've been able to grow, of course, we invest heavily in marketing these days. We wouldn't have achieved the scale that we have now without that. But that's essentially a magnifier for our organic growth. So word of mouth continues to this day to be our largest driver of new customers. And so, you know, I think my main advice is, focus more on what's going to make someone want to support you and tell someone about you than figuring out how to optimize your Facebook ad spend.
Got it. So you mentioned that it's a 10-year brand now, right? It started 10 years ago?
About that. Yeah. Yeah.
And you launched in America a few years back?
Yeah. So I think technically we launched in Australia in 2012. We had the idea a little bit sooner, but I think we launched in 2012. And we launched in the US about 3 years ago. And so in the UK at the same time.
What was the biggest challenge launching in another country, especially US? I would assume that the UK and Australia, maybe what you were talking about before with the brand and being pretty provocative. I'm assuming the UK and Australia could be pretty similar, but was there any other major challenges when launching in the US?
I actually think the brand resonated much better than we thought it would. And so we anticipated problems, but globally, it's been really well received. And I think people understand that it's about standing for something. And there's a pretty large percent of us out there who really want to support brands that stand for something. So that wasn't the main challenge, surprisingly. I think the biggest challenges were probably twofold. One was just resourcing. I think we thought, like, how hard could it be to, you know, copy paste our website and set up a warehouse in two new countries at once and start shipping product. Right. And so we decided to do both at once. And, you know, that's, I think many people in the business would probably say that was a mistake. I would say it was one of the best decisions we've ever made. We learned so much by launching both at once and seeing them both grow. In the early days, one of them would always be ahead of the other. And there were times when we thought, let's just kill it. But if we'd only launched that one, we might have killed it prematurely and never launched other markets. And so I think it was worth it. I think the other thing that's been a challenge is running a business in the US is significantly more complicated than it is running businesses in most of the other parts of the world. Just the structure of how you pay taxes in this country, in every state, has different rules. And then toilet paper is a category where some towns or counties require you not to charge tax, but other counties don't. So just managing the complexity of doing business in the States has been kind of mind-boggling for a society that prides itself on entrepreneurship.
Gotcha. And how do you manage that? You just get the right team in place and the right consultants to help you do that?
Exactly. Yeah. And look for tools that try to manage some of that complexity for us. So we do lean heavily on finding tools that do the things that we don't want to be best at. And so that we can focus most of our efforts on making our product and our team great.
Talking about the team, I've been fortunate. I was just talking offline before we started. I've been fortunate to have communicated with a number of your team members who have been so gracious with their time, so responsive. You know, when you're in a day where you're cold emailing people, people will ignore you and won't get back. But every single person that I've communicated with that who gives a crap has just been awesome. What goes in to building a team like that? And how do you ensure that you're all aligned with your mission?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot of talk right now about the importance of purpose-driven work, right? And we've recognized that from the beginning. And so we're in the fortunate position that that's baked into everything we do because we've really bootstrapped the business and really been in the driver's seat this whole time. We've been able to make decisions that most other businesses wouldn't be able to really keep impact front and center. There was, though, a pretty important moment about 5 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, that really helped sort of solidify how we think about this. And it was actually when we donated our first $1 million, major milestone for us as a business, something that, like, if you'd told me 10 years ago that we'd be donating $1 million, I would have said, that's impossible. Like, that's so much money. I can't even get my head around that much money.
Yeah.
And when it happened, we were, you know, celebrating internally and celebrating externally and really like super proud of what we'd accomplished with our team and our customers. But privately, Simon and I and a few others were having conversations that are like, well, what's next? And is like $1 million is a lot, but it's actually not a lot. There are over, at that point, there were 2.4 billion people in the world who didn't have access to a toilet. $1 million is not going to solve that. And so that forced us to really think bigger and think longer term and say, as a business, how, like, what's our real theory of change? How do we really think we're going to be able to do this? And we took a step back and did a lot of research and spoke with our advisors and basically carved out a plan that we think is insanely ambitious, but still attainable. And that's basically within the next 30 years, making sure every single person on the planet has access to a clean toilet.
Wow.
And there was a lot of math and sort of advice that went into that goal setting. But we basically set that as our North Star. Every single company-wide town hall, every single sort of major presentation starts with how this is helping us ladder up to that. Ultimately, of course, we've broken that down into a more concrete vision for the next 5 years of how we'll have the most impact possible in the next 5 years. And from that, we sort of chip away and do sort of annual strategy setting and quarterly goal setting across teams. But it all ladders up to that 30-year goal. And there's like 100% alignment around that goal internally, which is a tremendous source of clarity for us as a business.
Yeah, for sure. What about like, so when you're hiring, is there anything you're particularly looking for in a candidate when getting them to join your team?
Yeah, plenty of things. Good sense of humor is always always on the list, as you can imagine. Ultimately, though, we're actually not looking only at people who work in nonprofits or who work in social enterprises. For us, the bigger benefit is just building the pool of talent that's working on solving big problems in the world. And so if we can get someone from the big evil corpse of the world to you know, realize that it's possible to spend their days working towards a greater good, we're really excited about that. And we see that as part of our good influence on the world. So I don't think sort of experience in nonprofits or experience in social enterprises is that important for most roles. What I do think is important is values alignment at the end of the day. And so, you know, we have a really strong set of values internally. The first one is give a crap. And so we do look for people that even if they've, you know, worked for tobacco or firearm companies, I don't think we have any of those internally at the moment, but no matter what they've done in the past, we want to know that they're moving forward, that they are capable of making decisions based on values and that they are able to sort of do the right thing when push comes to shove. And so that's, you know, aside from technical competency, that's probably the number one thing we try to look for.
How do you evaluate that outside of, let's say you've got a candidate and they want to work for Who Gives a Crap and you're sending in an application, you're sending in your resume, and outside of your technical skills and experience, how would one, or how does Who Gives a Crap evaluate someone's values on paper?
That's a great question. On paper, it's hard, to be honest. Right. I think, you know, we do ask a number of questions in our application process that try to tease out some of these things. And so depending on the role, we might ask the question differently. You know, an example is hiring for a head of product development right now. One of the questions in our application is, what are some brands that you think do a great job of finding the right balance between quality and environmental performance, right?
Got it.
In order to answer that, you need to know a little bit about sort of environmental performance, but also understands the nuances that go into making decisions between environmental friendliness and quality and price and things like that. So that's one way, but I think it really comes out in our interview and homework process. So we go through several rounds of interviews with all candidates that culminate in a homework presentation for which we ask candidates to essentially answer usually three questions for us. And we pay them for their time, of course. But ultimately, throughout that process, we have a number of questions. And in all of the sort of the questionnaires that our team fill out afterwards, our values are listed there. And we encourage everyone to say, like, how do you think this candidate lives up to these values? So, you know, one of our values is stay scrappy. And so we would ask questions about, tell us about a time when you had a great idea and you pushed it across the line quickly, even when you didn't have enough resources. Or, you know, with give a crap, which is our lead value, tell us about a time when you had to make a a really difficult decision, but you know, walk us through how you made that decision and how you factored in values and doing the right thing with all of the other complexities involved in doing the work that people do. So that's really how we focus on it.
Have you seen that talent pool increase in terms of people that are excited to work at a mission-driven company?
Yeah, I mean, I think significantly. I think part of it is a growing recognition that it's possible to do this kind of work, which is really exciting. I think another part of it, unfortunately, is the economic situation globally right now. There are a lot more people out of work. But a third part of it, which is really exciting for us, is that we have a really growing brand awareness. And so we're getting candidates applying now that are like, have incredible backgrounds. And we still pinch ourselves when we get all of these applications saying like, do they know we're just a little toilet paper company? And but I think it's a testament to how far we've come and what a brand our team has built.
You were saying before when you launched in the US and the UK simultaneously, and you said there was a couple of people that thought that was a big mistake, and but you didn't. What's the biggest mistake that you think you've made at Who Gives a Crap? And how did you, what was the lesson you learned from it?
So many to name. Where to start? I think there's been a consistent one that a mistake that I've made many times, which I think is something I will always be working on. And I think it's probably something that many entrepreneurs face. It's just an overly optimistic bias about what's possible in a day with the team you have. We set very ambitious goals internally. And to be fair, we hit many of them, most of them.
Right.
But I think what we don't do a great job of is planning the resourcing of how we're going to hit those goals in far enough in advance to really be able to do them. And so the reason that's a problem for us in particular is because we have so many people who are so devoted to the mission and who believe so deeply in our purpose that they're willing to say yes to every challenge that comes their way. And they work nights and they put in the hours and get stuff done. And most companies would be really excited about that. But for us, we have a deep belief in the power of life-work balance.
Right.
And we want people to be putting their lives first. And we think that's the best recipe for success. Unfortunately, a lot of people go that extra mile and it can be a challenge to sort of give them the stability they need. And so I think one challenge that I think we as a business make is that we are often overly ambitious about how we resource things. And so it's something we're continuously working to try to improve.
Gotcha. Google has something like that as well, right? The way that they structure their goals, they say something like 50%
yeah.
want to be so outrageous that you're probably not going to get them, but at least you kind of get to a certain point and you're attempting to.
Yeah. And we use a similar framework. We've actually borrowed their framework directly. So we use their OKR framework. And so we actually aim to hit 70. Our goal is to hit 70% of our objectives. Which is great. And I think it's the right calibration. The challenge is when you know you're working for a higher purpose and you don't hit all of your goals, how does that make you feel? You know, it's like, it's not always a great feeling to hit your goals, even though you know intellectually that you set the goals too high on purpose. And so that's something we're constantly trying to evaluate internally is, you know, what's the right way of setting goals that is ambitious enough that we won't hit them all, but not so ambitious that we feel like we're letting our mission down when we don't hit them.
So there's three of you as co-founders. For an entrepreneur that's out there that's a solo founder at the moment, potentially thinking about bringing on a co-founder, what are the benefits of having a co-founder and how do you ensure that it's a successful relationship?
Like I would never, ever start a business alone, knowing what I know now, and not to say that it's not possible, my personal like skills and strengths, I just wouldn't be able to do it. So I'm very impressed with those who can. From my perspective, some of the benefits for me, you know, I'm very much an expansive thinker, and I you know, I'm a creative by background, and so I like to imagine what's possible. I have a really good understanding for a designer. I have a great understanding of the fundamentals of how a business operates. But I'm not naturally, I don't think in terms of like, how do I sort of make really quick decisions and contract my ideas? Mm-hmm. And so I've worked really well with my co-founders to collaborate and sort of push the boundaries and then narrow down and then push the boundaries and then narrow down. And also just to like, I've learned a tremendous amount from Simon and Jehan and the rest of our team as well. But the learning you get from people who are equally committed to something but have very different skill sets is pretty tremendous. And so so that's like a more practical thing. On a personal level, the confidence, it's not easy being an entrepreneur. It's, you know, everyone, and it never gets easier is what I'm realizing. And so even though the decisions change and we're less afraid that the we're going to go out of business tomorrow, everyone still looks to you for the answers and thinks that you know what lies ahead. And so it's a constant challenge on your confidence levels. And to do that alone is really challenging, but to do it knowing that you have the partnership of someone else, or in my case, two other people, and that even if you're making the wrong decision, that you have the support and you've had like the thumbs up from your co-founders gives you the confidence to move forward. And it's that confidence that you need more than the right answers. Like the right answers, you'll get them sometimes and you won't get them others, but you need the confidence to keep moving forward either way.
Danny, I'm scared. I'm a solo founder. Now I'm just like, well, maybe I need to bring on a co-founder.
Well, I do think what I would say though is you asked also about what advice I would give to people when they're thinking about this. You know, for those who are looking for co-founders or who are like considering a co-founder, I think what the balance that we have among us, honestly, magically worked out. We didn't put any thought into this, but we have a perfect overlap of skills in that we have the shared understanding of each other's skills. So for example, Simon and Jehan appreciate great storytelling and design and brands thinking and marketing, but they have no expertise or ability to do that, right? To create things. They're not designers. They're not copywriters. I have a deep understanding of the, you know, the fundamentals of a P&L and how our operations work. There is no way you could put me in front of a, you know, an Excel sheet and ask me to rebuild our P&L. And so there's this deep underlining respect for what the other part does, but recognition that you can't do it. And so if you're doing it alone, what I might suggest is that you look for that outside of your co-founder. So there are plenty of advisors who can help you, you know, fill out the skills that you need to fill out, or consultants or employees or colleagues. And so, but I would definitely look for that however you can.
Yeah. And it's really been mindful about where are your limitations and really where are your core competencies and where you need help on.
Totally. Totally agree.
It's very easy to, as an entrepreneurial mindset, being this kind of generalist and being able to kind of do everything, but there's going to be a time where you have to, if you want to scale, if you want to grow, you need that help.
Absolutely. And that scales with you and with the business. So one of the things I'm experiencing now is I reached the limits of my leadership abilities in some parts of the business. Some of the parts of the business I've been closest to for many years. And so it's hard when you've grown with the business sometimes to say, I just don't know that I have what it takes to really guide the team in this part anymore. And so it's this constant ability, or this constant comfort's the wrong word because it's never comfortable, but this constant openness to accepting that you might have limitations, but you can still find other ways of adding value.
How do you personally work through that, like coming to that realization?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that have helped me with that. And I should say it's not fully worked out yet. I'm still working through it, but and I always will be probably.
Yeah, right.
One thing I've realized is that, for example, as a designer in the early days, I was designing everything. I was physically on my computer designing things. And as a designer, you're in the business of making things physically. At the end of the day, you know how you're spending your time and how you've created value and what you've created. You can measure it in a sense. But then when you step back and you start managing designers or managing creatives, you get to the end of the day and you're like, all I did was sit in meetings, or all I did was think, or, you know, I didn't make anything today. What do I have to show for my day? And so one of the things that's helped me is hiring people who are way more capable than I am. And so when someone makes something and it looks less good than what you could have done, you'll probably never get over that feeling. If you hire someone who makes something that you would have never thought of, and it's so much cooler than anything you've ever created, it's pretty easy to say like, okay, I'm pretty comfortable in a management role and stepping away from the day-to-day.
And here's all the work that you've got to do.
Exactly.
Hand it off to them.
Exactly. And then the other thing I think that's been really helpful is working with a coach and getting feedback from people who feel comfortable giving you that feedback. Sometimes it just helps to have someone tap you on the shoulder and say, are you really happy doing this? And are you really excelling at this? And here's what I'm seeing, and let's work through this. And so getting that from my co-founders and an executive coach that we've worked with for many years, just really helpful to help me shape my understanding of myself.
That's such good advice. You've got your co-founders. Does this executive coach work with all of you, or you've got like individual coaches?
All of our planning and executive team, yeah.
Awesome. And you mentioned before as well, having advisors, having that support that may not be totally within the company, but people that are going to be able to help you out.
Totally.
What advice would you give to entrepreneurs that want to do good, that want to create a mission-driven company, specifically in the consumer good space? Has there been any kind of key lessons that you've learned that they should be aware of?
Yeah. I think a couple of things. One is make it fun. Like, you're going to be looking at this brand and this product for a very long time and talking about it all day and all night. I get to make toilet jokes all day. We make beautiful things. We donate a lot of money. We tell a lot of jokes. Like, what could be better, right? Like, right. I think at the end of the day, if it had all gone down in flames, I would have said, that was awesome. I would do that again in a heartbeat. So whatever you're doing, I would say, make it something you love. The second is, I just think that there's so many widgets being made now, and I'm just not a believer that everything needs innovation, that there's some things that people need and there's some things that we just really don't need. And so at the end of the day, like, I just wouldn't be happy with myself if I were making more widgets that were only going to landfills and not making the world a better place. So my personal bias is that I would advise people to make things that people truly need and try to actually solve problems in the world. It's just a much more meaningful way to run a business and attracts the kind of meaningful employment opportunities that I think people are yearning for these days.
Yep.
And then the third thing I think is, you know, from a physical product perspective, I would consider not making toilet paper. It's like just a really hard product to make work from a margin perspective and a logistics perspective. It was a crazy idea that Simon had, but I'm glad we figured it out and we're doing pretty well. But I'd suggest starting with something easier next time.
So what if you don't have that experience in the space in a product that you're actually creating and you need to find a manufacturer and all that kind of stuff? What's the direction there? Like, how does someone do that? Or is it like, just focus on maybe some experience that you've had around a particular
product? No, I think, I mean, none of us have ever done toilet paper before or any of the products we've launched. I think there are two things I suggest. One is lean into the value of being a beginner. Like, by being a beginner and not having that industry knowledge, you can question everything. I think we were probably the first mass market toilet paper company or the first consumer facing toilet paper company to wrap our rolls in paper and to ditch the plastic.
Yep.
I think we were probably the first to do a number of things. We're certainly one of the larger sellers of environmentally friendly toilet paper. We've been able to do that by challenging the status quo. And I think that comes from being an outsider and a beginner. But I would balance that with some expertise, and we sought that through advice. And so, for example, our current VP of supply chain, Phil, is an old colleague of mine from a previous career, and he was just an expert at figuring out how to get stuff made and negotiate with factories and find factories that lived up to their ethical promises and things like that. And so we leaned on him heavily as a friend and as an advisor before we started the business. And then a few years later, as soon as we were able to afford him to pay him, we hired him immediately. But definitely look for those experts in your network to help fill your gaps.
Gotcha. Especially when it comes to what you were saying, like looking for partners that are true to their word when it comes to sustainable practices and such. Is that the same with when you donate the monies that you've raised to charities that are working to build these restrooms in these places? Is that the same? Like, how do you manage that quality?
It is much the same. I think we probably know more than 99% of people about toilets, but we certainly don't know all of the ins and outs of what a person living in a dense urban environment in Bangladesh needs versus a person living in rural Kenya. That's just not our, we'll never know all of that, and no individual ever would. And so we lean pretty heavily on advisors for that too. And so we've built up a network of advisors in the sanitation space, lean on them pretty heavily to help us find and evaluate the right partners. We are, however, plug here. We are hiring for a head of impact right now, which is, if I weren't doing what I'm doing, I would be dropping everything and applying for that role because it's a pretty awesome opportunity. But we are looking for a single person to lead the strategy and to build that network of advisors and extended network to guide our decisions.
Awesome. I'm going to get that job up on Good Gigs. If anyone listening Head of Impact will be live on Good Gigs. Danny, 2020 has been insane. What are you hopeful for in 2021?
You know, this year has been really good for our business. We've grown a lot. We've learned a lot. We've really stepped up and answered the call of duty, I guess you could say. didn't realize the pun. That was actually not an intended pun. But if I could start this year over and not have the pandemic, I would do that in a heartbeat. You know, I think the stress it's put on our teams and our families and our customers, I would give anything to have the comfort in knowing that, you know, we can all leave our houses and work together in person. So what I'm hopeful for in 2021, although of course we're aiming for ambitious growth on the product side, I hope people can go back to work and stop buying so much toilet paper for their homes. I hope that, you know, it'll be hard for our business, but we're planning for it. We know it's going to happen, but I hope for that kind of normalcy for the world, and more than happy to sort of slow things down on our end to, you know, it's a small price to pay for us to get back to normal.
Yeah, I love that. Danny, thank you so much for coming on the show, giving your insight into what's happening over Who Gives a Crap and what you're doing over there. I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate all the work that you guys are doing. It's incredible. Thank you so much, buddy.
Thank you. Really appreciate it and love what you're doing too.
So I have to point out first that although we just recorded this conversation last week, Danny has informed me that they've already closed the application process for the head of Impact role because, as you could imagine, it was an incredibly popular opportunity and they've already received hundreds of applicants. But make sure to sign up to goodgigs.app for job alerts so you don't miss out on working with a phenomenal team and brand. Now, if you're thinking about starting your own business and you're exploring an area you don't have deep knowledge of, I love Danny's advice about leaning into your outsider perspective. It's from this point of view that you could come up with a really novel innovation that hasn't been thought of before because folks are too close to the problem. I've included Danny's Instagram in the show notes. Go show him some love and let him know which piece of his advice resonated with you. And if you loved what you heard on this episode, I'd be so appreciative if you left a rating and review. It helps others find the podcast and grows our community of awesome humans. Until next week, thanks for showing up and being you.